Welcome to the Eco Right Speaks podcast, your conservative home for weekly climate news, interviews, points of view, and profiles of people leading on climate in local communities across the country. It's the Eco Right Speaks podcast, brought to you by the team at republicen.org. And now, here's your host, Chelsea Henderson.
Hello, and welcome to the Eco Right Speaks, your climate-focused podcast produced by the team at republicen.org. I'm your host, Chelsea Henderson, reveling in all that is April, except for the allergens. But it's all part of the ecological system, as today's guest very much understands. Ecologist Dr. Michael Curran owns and operates Abnova Ecological Solutions. A certified ecological restoration practitioner and certified wildlife biologist, he received both the top MS and top PhD student award in the country by the American Society of Reclamation Sciences upon completing his graduate degrees. He developed techniques to improve reclamation and restoration monitoring and also pioneered the use of spatially explicit dashboards to rapidly report reclamation monitoring results, allowing for informed decision-making and easy-to-interpret data. Mike has worked with 26 oil and gas companies in reporting reclamation and restoration data to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Conservation Efforts Database prior to the 2015 Endangered Species Act listing decision of the greater sage-grouse, and was acknowledged by the Fish and Wildlife Service for the importance of his contributions. He's here, listeners, to give us some Reclamation 101. So stay tuned for my conversation with Dr. Mike Curran. Welcome back, listeners. I'm so excited to be in conversation today with Dr. Mike Curran. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on. I'm excited to chat.
So, listeners, for this episode, we've gone back to Wyoming. Mike heard our episode a few episodes back with Dr. Holly Krutka, and thought that he would love to come on and share with you, our listeners, the work that he is doing in reclamation. And so, I know there is an entire federal agency devoted to reclamation efforts, and I have to admit, I am not entirely sure that I know what that means. So why don't you break it down for us? What is it that you do, and why is it important to, in the greater scheme of things?
Yeah, so I'm an ecologist by training. I have a PhD in ecology from the University of Wyoming. And during my time there, I was mainly researching reclamation associated with oil and gas development. I worked a little bit with active mining. And then about 2 years ago, I started ecological services company where I do some research and general consulting. And I also work with abandoned mine lands out in the western states. So what we're doing during reclamation or restoration, whatever you want to call it, is trying to just make sure that our footprint after development or energy extraction isn't permanent. So we're trying to put back the land surface to a state that's stabilizing soils, providing ecosystem services. There's been really a big push in the last decade or so on going from just stabilizing soils and preventing weeds after development towards making sure that our well pads and our pipeline systems are becoming wildlife habitat again. So it's been a lot of fun. I get asked a lot, oh, what's fracking? And I don't really deal with fracking or anything below the surface. I'm dealing with, right at the ground level, how to handle soils, what kind of seed mixes to use, and how to get things to grow, and how to get wildlife and pollinators and, ecosystem services back to lands that we need for development.
Well, and, one thing that I found really interesting that you mentioned in our correspondence before you came on the show was that it, I'm going to use the word annoyed, maybe annoyed is too strong of a word, but how it kind of annoyed you or irked you that people do tend to think of oil and gas infrastructure as permanent disturbances on lands. And it sounds like the work you do actually really mitigates that and in fact improves the ecosystem around these infrastructures.
Yeah, it's interesting to me because I think a lot of people inherently just think oil and gas is bad, that it's only producing fossil fuels, and you don't really hear a lot of positives about oil and gas. I've been working in this field for 14, probably in restoration and reclamation for about close to 20 years, related to industry for about 14 years. And just the advancements that have been made from the oil and gas industry during that time, I think, are pretty remarkable. But yeah, it's interesting. After, like, a pipeline, for example, is buried into the ground, there is this initial surface disturbance to bury the pipe, but that soil is then respread over the pipe, and these sites are seeded usually within that same year. And then our well pads surface is disturbed by stripping soil and removing vegetation, basically to just flatten the ground and allow for construction equipment to come on. But also, typically within a year of construction completion, somewhere between 65 and 80% of a well pad is put back into what they call interim reclamation. So, you know, in the Jonah field where I work, the average well pad size is about 5.3 acres, and roughly four and a half to 5 acres of that within 1 year is going back into reclamation and being seeded. And then, yeah, within a year of that, we're seeing, like, some of my research suggests 22 times more pollinating insects, wow, increased floral diversity, increased native grass diversity. And, you know, after 3 or 4 years, we're starting to see more above ground biomass and net primary productivity. But one example in the Jonah field, we see 450 pounds of vegetation per acre compared to what it was previously, was 270 pounds. So we're almost doubling our above ground biomass, which is really a good story for the carbon cycle, that we're actually using these pads to, and photosynthesis, to bring carbon back into that slow moving pool and vegetation and into our soils.
Well, and one thing that I think I really like about this is how intentional it is, that you can really plant for the ecosystem, and, you know, very, very much fraction of a percent smaller example. A few years ago, Public Works in my town redid all the sidewalks and streets. And in doing that, they ripped up what I call the hell strip right between the sidewalk and the street. And it had just been, you know, grass before, and they, you know, ripped it up. And then when they were finishing up, they just randomly threw some grass seed in that area. And of course, what ended up growing there? Weeds. So I had to go back in and say, okay, I don't really want it to be grass I have to mow. I'm going to plant some, you know, some pollinators and plant some things here that are hardy and sustainable. And so it sounds like what you can do in these sites is sort of the same thing. When land is sort of left untended, you know, especially today, I think we do have a bigger problem with invasive species than we have in the past, but you can really control what goes there and create food webs for the wildlife that is in the area where you're working.
Yeah, no, you're spot on. And it's interesting you bring up that story, because I got my background working in kind of suburbia with an entomologist at University of Delaware called Doug Ptolemy. Doug wrote a book called Bringing Nature Home, How to Sustain Wildlife in Your Backyard by the Use of Native Plants. And when I was working with him, we were studying how terrestrial food webs responded to alien or non-native plants versus native plants. So we'd plant Japanese maples and then native maples, or Norway spruce and native spruce, or, you know, an oak tree native to Europe or Asia that you could buy at the local nursery, compared to a native oak. And we'd find a native white oak would host 537 species of caterpillar, versus the Eurasian oaks host somewhere around, you know, 10 to 13 caterpillars. Through that work, we found that 96% of terrestrial birds rear their young primarily on insects. These songbirds out in the mid-Atlantic are mainly rearing their young on caterpillars. So just by planting a native oak versus a non-native oak, if you've got, you know, a 50-time increase of the amount of caterpillars you're hosting, if mom chooses to build her nest in that native oak, her babies get nutrition a lot faster. And you have, you know, this big cascading effect. So I've been able to take a lot of those concepts out into the Western states and work with oil and gas operators. Just talk to them the importance of using native seeds and being intentional about it. And, you know, one of our big issues out there is this greater sage grouse, which is a species of concern in 11 Western states and 2 Canadian provinces. I'm doing some research currently with an intern of mine She's an undergrad at Colorado State University. Her name's Bee Bott, and she's really looking at the sage grouse diet. And I'm comparing that to some of the work I'm doing with oil and gas operators. And for example, if we get this Rocky Mountain bee plant, a native plant that does a really good job of outcompeting invasives, we find somewhere between 77 and 144 times more leaf beetles on our reclaim sites than in our reference. After ants, that seems to be the number one source of protein for sage grouse chicks. So it's kind of cool. And that's within 1 year. So it's really neat. And I think the more we learn, the more intentional we are.
And really important because, you know, don't get me on my soapbox about the use of pesticides and like Mosquito Joe. I see those signs out where I am in the DC area everywhere. And the idea that they are spraying a chemical that only hurts the mosquitoes and not your fireflies and your butterflies and your, you know, all the pollinators, the caterpillars, to me is a little crazy and misleading. But we do have an issue sort of with pollinators. We need to be making better ecosystems for them, supporting ecosystems for them. And so it sounds like the work that's going on where you are out west is really helpful, and I'm happy to hear that. I'm curious, who are your clients? Do you work? So, listeners, as I mentioned in the intro, Mike founded and operates Ebnova Ecological Solutions, and they do this work, the reclamation, restoration, planning, and monitoring, reporting, and so forth. So are you working with federal agencies, state agencies, oil and gas industries? Like who comes to you and says, we need you?
I actually have all of those as clients. Right now I have a couple pipeline companies. I work with a few, that would be the midstream oil and gas, a couple upstream companies, the well pads and the exploration and extraction companies. And with them, I work on a variety of things from reclamation planning, soil management, seed mix design, and stuff like that, to vegetation monitoring, biodiversity studies, wildlife surveys, and then data management and kind of decision management of, if this is what our site's looking like today, what decision do we make? Do we spray it? Do we leave it? Do we have to reseed it? And so on and so forth. I work on a couple grants from the Wyoming Game and Fish, and also some federal grants. I do a bit of work with the Bureau of Land Management. Has asked me to be the expert review on some recent reclamation guidelines and things like that. And then I actually work with a couple of solar companies and some private landowners where I work with them on just conservation related issues on, you know, if we're going to develop, what kind of seed mixes should we be using to make sure that we're doing as little impact as possible on these birds and other wildlife. So I kind of have a diverse base of clients, but it's fun to work with all of them and try to find some middle ground.
You're listening to the Eco Right Speaks podcast, brought to you by the team at republicen.org. Download, listen, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, including Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Now, back to this week's episode.
Now, I've been hearing about the sage grouse. You mentioned it earlier. Basically, when I first started working on Capitol Hill in 1997, I feel like people were talking about the sage grouse, and I was on the Environment and Public Works Committee, which had some jurisdiction, maybe over BLM at the time. And it was not an issue that I worked on. I just remember hearing it all the time. So how much of your work is driven by Endangered Species Act concerns and regulation that requires a certain, you know, land to be left in a certain way? Or is this work that you're doing when you're going in and reclaiming or replanting one of those pads you were mentioning, is that something that oil and gas companies are doing because it's like a good neighborly thing to do? Or are there some requirements that they leave the land in a certain condition?
I think a little bit of both. And I guess it's sort of hard to answer how much exactly is due to threatened and endangered species. The stuff I do with Wyoming Game and Fish is directly out of sage grouse funding. Oil and gas operators have state policy from the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality, and every state has what's called a stormwater pollution prevention plan, which is a site stabilization plan, whether you're on federal, state, or private land. If you're on federal land, every BLM field office in the Western states has a different set of regulatory criteria, and they've been around before this bird was really a major species of concern. So sometimes it's challenging because meeting your regulatory goals set in place by the federal government is not always equivalent to improving habitat.
Right.
I do
imagine
think,
that.
Yeah. Right. No, it's crazy. I mean, that was one of a good friend of mine who was a reclamation specialist in industry at the time. She was working for, I think, the largest landowner in the state of Wyoming, where they had assets in across, I think, like 8 or 9 BLM field offices. And she always would say, you know, the hardest thing for me is I don't have any specific goal, because what they want me to do in this field is totally different than what they want me to do in this other field. I do think since 2010 or so that a lot of companies have been being proactive and maybe being a little bit more intentional of getting away from site stabilization only to, we've really got to make sure that these birds are using this habitat. And they're going even above the reclamation aspect of, where are we going to put our well pad to make sure that we're so many miles away from breeding grounds? How are we going to place our road systems and our pipeline systems through this field to make sure we're doing minimal disturbance in the first place? A lot of them will say we won't even put vehicles out in the field from March 15th through the end of April to not disturb these birds from breeding, or to not disturb migratory animals. And then, yeah, I think that was kind of a starting point for some companies to say, hey, we got to fund some research and really figure out how to do this right, not just the bare minimum site stabilization, but yeah, how do we increase the pollinators? How do we increase the bird food? How do we get the flowers and the grasses and other things they need in their diet back out here? So, yeah, indirectly, probably a lot of oil and gas companies. And I think some of it, like, you know, in Pinedale and the Jonah Field, most of the people that work for those companies live right in that community. And you talk to some of them, and the reclamation specialist will say, you know, I want my children to be able to hunt antelope out where I grew up hunting antelope. Like, I want to put these lands back together just to be a good steward of the environment and be a good neighbor to my backyard. So yeah, there's some of that too.
I mean, what I really love about this story that you're telling is the interconnectedness of it, right? It's not like any one entity is just going out and doing their thing. There's a holistic approach that is really integrating, you know, what you're saying, where does the road go? Where is the optimal place for this? And for that, you're just all working as a unit. And that is how our ecology works. So it makes sense that when you are trying to marry ecology and more human constructed infrastructure, that you're doing it in a way that has that balance.
Yeah. And I think you're right there. It takes a lot of people. What I really like about restoration ecology or ecological restoration or reclamation is it's a pretty broad field, ranging from soil scientists to botanists to wildlife biologists to, you know, weed and plant scientists. Economics plays a role and so on. So hydrology is a big thing, especially in our arid environments out in the West. So yeah, there's a lot of moving pieces to it. And then I think, you know, Wyoming has been a great place for some of this work for a variety of reasons. I think in part, they have the largest intact sage grouse population. So they've, you know, most of the other Western states look at Wyoming on what are they doing to conserve this bird and how do we follow suit? Just about a year ago, Bob Budd, who runs the Wyoming Wildlife and Natural Resource Trust and is the chair of the sage grouse implementation team in Wyoming, has put together this reclamation and restoration task force. And I'm excited to be working with them and working with different industries, understanding their best management practices. So we're not really reinventing the wheel, but Bob's been really creative of putting these groups together, of making sure there's somebody from every industry, from every agency, from the Audubon Society and other NGOs, and, you know, sometimes groups that you wouldn't necessarily think would work together all have a seat at these tables. And it's kind of neat. You'll see an executive from the Wyoming Mining Association sitting right next to somebody really high up in the Audubon Society trying to solve the same problem. Yeah. So it's cool.
That is great. And, you know, that's how we solve problems, is by working together. And on that note, how can, if there are any listeners who are interested in learning more about the services that you provide, how can they find you?
My website is abnovaecology.com. I have a list of services on there. I try to keep most of my, I still do a lot of peer review research and stuff. So I try to keep that all freely accessible. There's a publications tab on there as well. I'm on LinkedIn, and yeah, you can get all my contact information off my website or my LinkedIn pages, but that would probably be the best way.
Well, thank you for sharing the work that you do and educating us about reclamation and how this works, especially as it pertains to oil and gas infrastructure. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I learned something, and I really like it when I can learn something. It means our listeners are probably learning something too.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on. I think the United Nations has declared 2021 to 2030 as the decade of ecosystem restoration. Just saying, you know, we've got to really do a good job of putting our land back intact and getting ecosystems functioning to a high level. So I'm glad I get to be a part of it, and super happy to see some of the really proactive work that the industry has been doing here.
Well, I'm glad to have somebody like you overseeing that. So thank you for your service. And listeners, you can, as Mike noted, you can find Abnova Ecological Services at abnovaecology.com, abnovaecology.com. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you. Have a great day.
So, Price, how was your vacation?
Fun in the sun. What else could Hawaii be? Warm, cool, crystal clear, blue water. It was awesome.
What island were you on?
Oahu.
I like Oahu. I've been to Oahu and Maui and the Big Island. So
yeah, see, look at you. You've been far, far more Hawaii seasoned. Aloha. Mahalo. See, I learned a few things while we were there.
It is a magical place. I'm glad you got to go. And I'm sure you saw lots of different fish and flower. I mean, that's the thing that really strikes me when I'm there, is like the flora and the fauna are so different from anywhere else I've ever been in the U.S.
Colors like, is what I'm left with. Is the colors
the
of everything.
And yeah, such a beautiful place. And I know this is a far-fetched, because Hawaii, Wyoming, pretty far apart. But today's guest, ecologist. Oh my gosh, I totally had
You don't pivot to me on Hawaii and not give us a report on Jordan. I mean, you bike through sand. I mean,
I rode a bike
tough.
And I'm lived to tell about it. So there we go. No, really, I'd never been to a Middle Eastern country. It was really fantastic. The food, the people were so welcoming. And I think that really struck me. And because tourism is really down in Jordan because of the war in Gaza, yeah. You know, seeing places like Petra, there are hardly any other tourists. So it was almost like we had it to ourselves. And, you know, when you go to like one of the seven wonders of the world, you're sort of expecting it to be crowded. So yeah, it was really fantastic and a great bonding experience for me to have with my college roommate.
Yeah, absolutely.
So glad she invited me to go on that. And so now I will pivot and say,
yes,
very different from Jordan and Hawaii, but the state of Wyoming and ecologist there, that's how we say the word, Dr. Mike Curran was just fantastic talking about reclamation and giving us a little insight into how that process works and how you can take some heavy, you know, human created infrastructure and make it something that is ecologically sustainable and beneficial to the environment, to the food web and all of that. So great to hear from him. And you know what? He was a guest because he heard our episode with Dr. Holly Kretka, and he took the initiative to reach out to us and say, hey, I have a story to tell too. So that is just a way of saying to our listeners, if you have a story that you think we should feature, reach out to us. We're here. We're open to that.
Absolutely. And that's it's spreading. That's what we love to hear is new people hearing the podcast, which you'll hear a new episode every Tuesday from now until through the summer, midsummer at least. Season 8 as we barrel on in Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, whatever is your favorite podcast platform. That is where you can listen to us every single week, Chelsea.
So I saw our old dear friend, past podcast guest Alex Posner tonight. Mm-hmm. He asked us if we were going to have as many seasons of the podcast as there were seasons of Friends. And I laughed because I'm not really sure how many seasons of Friends there were, but it felt like a lot. So that's a lot of work to do. But we will certainly shoot for the stars on that. And, you know, I would be remiss in not also just bringing up another past podcast guest, but since our last recording, you know, we've had a little break from our listeners, but we lost Senator Joe Lieberman, a real hero in my book. For those of you that read Glacial, The Inside Story of Climate Politics, he really, and this struck me when I was writing the book, what a through line he was on enacting bipartisan comprehensive climate legislation through the U.S. Senate. And he looked for those bipartisan partners to work with, and he was a dog with a bone. He didn't stop. I was honored to get to work with him on one bill, just really saddened at his loss. And, you know, it just gets harder and harder when you see these old giants of the Senate start to move on. And it's a different body than it was when I worked in it, as the House is different from when you worked in it. And you know, I just feel incredibly lucky that I had that opportunity to be around him. And he was so supportive of the book and, you know, gave me a great blurb. And we were going to do an event together in New York City. And so, I mean, I'm sad in all the ways, but sad for his family and also just grateful that I had the opportunity and the honor to get to work with him.
Yeah, the ones like Senator Lieberman, you know, Senator McCain, Senator John Warner, who you work for, the giants and titans that always were always trying to work across the aisle to bridge the gap. And those kind of giants that did that were a fabric of the institution instead of ones that are there now almost tearing down that fabric.
Yeah.
You know, it's just it just hurts to lose people that were doing good for the country, like Senator Lieberman, that just seemed to be extinct in many ways now.
For sure, for sure. So, but honored that I got that exposure and opportunity. And you know, one thing when I first heard the news, I immediately thought of the people I knew who worked for him, and just how many people I'm friends with today who at one point or another passed through his office, and good friends. And I think that is also a testament when somebody hires good people, and those people, you know, stay in your life. And anyway, RIP, JIL, as he was referred to in every memo I wrote for John Warner. John Warner was JW and Lieberman was JIL, his initials. So little inside baseball for those listeners who have not worked on the Hill, at least in the Senate. I don't know if this is a House thing. Senators always mostly used three-letter initials when you were referring to them by memo or even in talking to staff, but Warner did not use his extra W. He was just JW. He didn't do the JWW. But yeah, JIL, RIP.
Wow. Well, that's certainly an experience of a lifetime that you had, you know, the many years you worked and were doing great work in the Senate and getting to work with those giants like Senator Lieberman. So, you know, certainly God rest in peace to an incredible patriot. I think that, to me, that's one of the best ways to describe somebody like Senator Lieberman. So as we forge ahead, with you, our listeners, and we will forge ahead with a new episode now that we're back from spring break. We will have another one next week. But first, shout out to a few new members, Talmadge G and Mark T, both in South Carolina, Laurel H in Florida, Lois C in Wyoming, and then also India B in California. Thanks for standing with us, which you can do at republican.org/join. It takes mere seconds. We would love to have you if you have not already done so, Chels.
Yeah, and you know, we say it every week. You get my newsletter. It's informative. People love it. And you get to find out when the podcast is dropped too. If you are a member, you will get the, you can see our show notes. You can keep tabs on who's the guest next week. I mean, just so many reasons to be a member. And also, you're important and our community is important. So be with us. We're fun.
Absolutely.
And we're a little melancholy tonight, but we're fun. We're fun. Yes. We're tired from vacation. We're sad with sad news, but we're fun people.
Yes, we are. And we're fun with you, our listeners. And so we just, once again, as we do every week, thank you for investing the time and wherever it is, whatever time it is, you know, for you investing to listen to us every single week. Hopefully you listen every week, but if you don't, you can go back and listen to past episodes on our website, republican.org/podcast. And like we said, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever it is you get your podcasts, we have got plenty of content to keep you busy. So if you're a new listener, welcome. If you're a longtime listener, we thank you. But until next week, Chels, we'll do it again.
Me too. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to this week's edition of the Eco Right Speaks podcast, brought to you by the team at republicen.org. You can listen to past episodes of the Eco Right Speaks podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And make sure to visit us online to find out how you can sign up to stand with us at republicen.org.